Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work. People who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Welcome to the show. My name is Alex Matias, and I'm a director at Arabella Advisors that focuses on supporting fiscally sponsored projects and boards at the nonprofits that we manage. Thank you for joining our kickoff episode for season two, where I got to connect with a former Arabellan and a good friend of mine, Gabriel Jones. We got to partner together over our time at the firm on an important environment initiative that built capacity in nonprofit organizations across the country. As a rising thought leader in the environmental justice movement, we thought it was great to hear his perspective on the defining issue of our time. I'm excited and looking forward to having you hear the conversation we had over Zoom. Thanks again for tuning in. How about we get started just sharing a bit about your journey? I know that right now, you know, you are with Chicago Frontline, but if you could just spend a couple minutes sharing how you got to where you're at now.
So I'm Gabriel Jones, Associate Director with Chicago Frontline's Funding Initiative, or CFFI. And CFFI is a grassroots-led, grassroots-accountable, intermediary within Chicago that provides a capacity-building support for anchor environmental justice organizations out here and is really invested in growing the environmental justice ecosystem, you know, to address a lot of pollution concerns and other issues in the city. And so we support a cohort of five organizations as well who have, you know, who work in different parts of the city, predominantly in the most impacted parts of Chicago, including the South and Southwest, you know, corridors. And so I was, you know, prior to this was had the pleasure of working with, you know, the wonderful folks at Arabella, including yourself,
yes.
You know, Alex. So, but maybe even, you know, getting back to before how I got to Arabella, I'll just quickly say, you know, I sort of entered the environmental justice world largely through a research and kind of academic perspective. I grew up in Southern California. I grew up outside of LA, learned about grew up in a different neighborhood from where some of my family lived at the time in LA, and learned about, you know, environmental justice kind of through research that was going on literally in places where my family, you know, has lived and where I still had some family up there. So that kind of took me into this research mode that brought me to graduate school at the University of Michigan, where I worked under and forever indebted to Dr. Dorcita Taylor, who's really led a lot of awesome efforts out there. Through my time at Michigan, I got connected with the Environmental Fellows Program, which is was a collaboration at the time between Dr. Taylor at the University of Michigan and the Environmental Grantmakers Association. And that kind of just dovetailed into this environmental philanthropy world where, you know, I eventually ended up at Arabella Advisors after spending some time at EGA and got to work with a lot of different donors who are really invested in building the environmental justice movement, supporting it, and making sure that, you know, it's able to advance a lot of priorities.
I grew up in the Bronx in New York, and similar to you, just went about life, not really knowing about the environment space. And it was only when I joined Arabella, and more specifically supported Windward, the Windward Fund, that I got to see the whole host of issues that, you know, project leaders were working on, particularly those where, you know, there was a central focus on equity and making sure that, you know, we were advancing rights for all as it relates to the environment. And so one of the things that I want to touch on with you, like right out the gate, since you mentioned it, is, as you know, whether it's temperature, extreme weather events, or sea level rise, there's been an impact on all folks across the country in recent memory, given global warming and you know, the increasing effects that, you know, humans have had on our planet. And so the question to you really is, like, why in particular environment justice? So if you can orient folks to what environmental justice is, and how is that different from, or I guess a separate initiative than, you know, the broader global warming efforts and impacts that, you know, folks are experiencing nowadays?
Yeah, for sure. It's a good question. And so let me just back up a bit to also say, you know, the environmental justice movement is kind of decades old at this point, right? You know, a lot of folks trace it back to, you know, kind of the historic fights that were going on over PCB spillings, over like contamination that was going on in Warren County in North Carolina, I think in the late 70s, early 80s. But, you know, even prior to that, folks linked it back to like kind of work that Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, Jr. Was doing in Memphis, Tennessee with, you know, with sanitation workers as well, who were, you know, were being kind of disproportionately impacted. So this work has been going on. There's been kind of a lot of organizations that have come up and that have been built out. But I just want to paint the picture in terms of a really established field, you know, at this point. But, you know, when I think about environmental justice, I think there's kind of different ways to define it. The US EPA, you know, talks about it sort of in two dimensions. So they think about the fair distribution of environmental hazards in communities so that they're not disproportionately placed in communities of color, in low-income communities, tribal, you know, tribal nations and on indigenous lands. And then also the providing opportunities for the meaningful participation of these, you know, those very same communities who are impacted within policy and planning processes in order to, you know, prevent those kind of places from getting there in the first place and having a say really in what, you know, goes into these communities too. I think that's one lens. You know, another lens, I think a lot of EJ leaders really think about it holistically too, to just say that it's just as much about, preventing pollution from being put in communities so much as it is from like, you know, so much as it is to put like more green space in communities, right? Like we know that communities, you know, in lots of places, it's not, you can definitely see where, you know, there's polluting entities right next to communities, and at the same time you see a dearth, right, of like parks, really usable and upkept parks, or like tree canopy and stuff like that, which is actually a big deal for, you know, for climate impacts and things. So, and then to add the, you know, to that point about the climate lens, these very same communities that have been these, you know, as folks would say, frontline communities, who, you know, meaning that they're on the front lines of kind of these environmental injustices. These very same communities are not only dealing with these impact, you know, these polluting entities, and difficult policy challenges in their communities. But they're also, right, like when we talk about climate change impacts, these communities are, you know, are hit first and worst, right? So they're also suffering from increased, or not necessarily suffering, but experiencing increased flooding, more heat exposure. Right. And a host of, you know, whether it's displacement from wildfires, you know, a host of other things. So that's where kind of that climate justice lens calls attention to the intersections of all of these efforts as it relates to how climate impacts communities specifically.
Yeah. And you just touched on a lot of the local work that takes place and sort of moving this work forward. But you've also seen an intentionality on the part of, you know, federal and state officials. I can think of, you know, the Justice 40 movement, a press release that just came out, I think a few days ago from the Biden administration of some of the initiatives that they've led to really integrate environmental justice into every aspect and form of government. In your view, how do you feel things are going right now? Do you feel like there's more alignment between, you know, federal, state and local efforts, or do you feel like there's still a disconnect?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think, like when I think about how I kind of got and learned about EJ, you know, environmental justice as a field and saw what was going on, you know, in California and to where I am now, like there has been like, there's certainly been a lot of momentum. I mean, the fact that like, you know, yeah, that people even know about environmental justice now and like are tying that to things that are going on in their cities, right? And or just like recognizing the fact that, hey, yeah, like, you know, it's no coincidence that these communities of color and you know, communities that have been historically disinvested in are experiencing pollution. You know, there lots of folks are seeing those ties now, but I think that, and as you mentioned, there's lots of good initiatives going on and coming out. I think it'll be a question to see like how this plays out. You know, the there's certainly lots of great, like Justice 40 is great, lots of things, you know, coming out of kind of the Build Back Better agenda. Certainly lots of things going on at the state level. Here in Illinois, actually, they just passed the Clean Energy Clean Energy Jobs Act, or CEJA, you know, which will kind of help boost renewables, connect folks into, you know, green workforce opportunities and things like that. And I think what's going to be kind of a key bellwether is just like, again, how are we seeing these impacts in frontline communities, and how are frontline communities going to be involved in kind of the distribution of these resources and dissemination of them too, because I think there can sometimes be there's still a little bit of there's still a little bit of a politics behind this in terms of who's able to access those dollars, and are they really, you know, would we consider them to be like frontline organizations and you know, really environmental justice organizations that are place-based, led by and or, you know, predominantly serving communities of color, low-income communities, tribal nations. So I'd say I'm cautiously optimistic in terms of, you know, a lot of great things coming out, and then just really hopeful to be able to really start to see, you know, a lot of the impact on the ground too.
That piece around power is pretty prevalent and important, and I want to elevate it, especially considering some of the work that you've done over the past couple of years. And I think it nicely ties into the role of philanthropy. And so, you know, if you could really speak to, you know, some of the work that you've done to sort of get folks from the frontline communities involved in decision making and in resource allocation, I think that would be great, particularly as we see a shift in how folks are giving and how they go about deciding who to give that funding to. So if you could just speak to perhaps our work together on the fund or some of the other initiatives you've led, that'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and you read my mind as I was thinking of that as you said power. So So maybe to also throw some context into kind of like where philanthropy is fitting into environmental justice, right? Like we know, you know, a statistic that has been kind of thrown around a lot lately and really for good reason, because it's been showing the disparity, is that the building equity for alignment or building equity and alignment for EJ produced a report along with the New School that showed that among kind of the you know, these top national funders, only 2% of funding that was going towards environment was actually going towards what they had a strict definition around, you know, environmental justice work. And so again, while there's been environmental justice is becoming more mainstream and such, you know, kind of, I would say vis-a-vis like the DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion kind of piece. Money is still kind of moving pretty slowly, right? And so that's why I was really excited to be, you know, involved with and you know, become part of the Fund to Build Grassroots Power, which is a project of the Windward Fund, you know, started by a large national funder, and is really not only focused on devoting resources to frontline organizations across, you know, the U.S. and through a set of you know, national networks, and we're talking like over, you know, 150 different organizations across the country, but is also like building this kind of participatory piece too, right? To your point about power, so it's not so much about like, okay, let's just give folks resources, but it's like, how do we create these you know, participatory structure so that, you know, in this case, members of these national networks who are, you know, who have ties to the various organizations across the country are able to direct, you know, direct and kind of work in coordination with their members as to how funding can be allocated across, you know, across all the organizations. And that's been a pretty big deal. The fund is, I mean, you might know more than me at this point, but I was going to say, I feel like the fund is probably, you know, been able to allocate over at least over like $20 million or so, you know, over these past 3 years and such. And what I'll just quickly maybe add on to that too, is that like the fund is part of a broader community, right, of what folks call participatory grant making. And I actually think that when you talk about power and kind of where philanthropy sits into that, you know, this question around who's able to, what does it look like to democratize the resource decision-making kind of process? I think that certainly extends beyond environmental justice into like a host of other issue areas, and really is about kind of how do we make sure that dollars that have been made kind of on the backs of a lot of communities of color and in particular areas, are able to be led by folks from those communities as well too, or redirected, I should say, you know, by folks from those communities to ensure that it's kind of going into the right hands and towards the right efforts.
We talked about the role that government is playing, the policies that they're passing, and the initiatives that they're leading. We've sort of moved into, you know, philanthropy and the role that philanthropy can play in sort of moving this work forward, this work around democratizing decisions and allocating resources in an equitable manner, but also in building the capacity of many organizations that are leading initiatives on the ground. And I want to sort of touch or go back to a report that you had participated or had a hand in producing around non-endowed funds. Number one, I'd love for you to sort of provide some context around that report and sort of the argument that it made. But number two, I want to also get your perspective, particularly as it relates to what we've seen in the news recently. We've seen folks who have made a lot of, who've gotten very wealthy in the private sector, writing out checks to organizations for large sums of money. And, there's been questions around, is this the most effective way to go about supporting these organizations or supporting the movement? And so as you look back at that report that you published, do you feel like that needs to be, that argument that you made needs to be elevated more? Or do you feel like, you know, that it, that the contribution and the commitments that they're making are just as important as the non-endowed funds that exist supporting different issue areas?
Yeah, certainly. So maybe to speak to the non-endowed funds piece and then kind of where, maybe just how intermediaries are factoring into like, you know, this conversation around increased wealth generation, you know, separately. The non-endowed fund and I believe the memo is called like how non-endowed funds can, you know, advance impact in environmental philanthropy or something to that effect. It's been a few years now, but the memo was really, started because there have been a growth in, you know, intermediary type funds over these past couple of years. And some of them are focusing on, right, like environmental justice, climate justice. And I think, you know, it's donors can get, you know, whether it's larger foundations or kind of small to mid-size or family foundations, or just individuals, may not necessarily kind of understand how each of these intermediaries are operating, mm-hmm. or I should, you know, more correctly state non-endowed funds, because they are particularly ones that don't have, you know, like a more traditional endowment setup. How these funds are, how they're operating, like if they are supporting, you know, work in similar areas, then how are they still differentiated, but kind of, you know, acting in a complementary capacity. And so what went into creating that memo was, kind of convening just a core kind of group of funds that are featured in the memo, understanding kind of where, you know, each of them are working. We actually found that I think only when we looked at like the grantee list across all of the funds, we only found that like maybe there was like 9% or less than that overlap, you know, in terms of like same grantees. And so they're actually, you know, kind of covering covering a lot of ground individually. And yet, you know, there are kind of some areas where there might be some key ties or key partnerships and, you know, and can elevate that. But more importantly, there are funds that, you know, have a prominent focus on kind of like supporting frontline leadership and frontline organizations. And so this was kind of, the memo was meant to help illustrate how that's important, you know, why that's also strategically important too. It provides a number of kind of examples of, you know, of policies and kind of initiatives that have come about. That's obviously that, you know, like I said, that was written a couple of years ago. And so that's changed. Yeah. And even more has come out since then. So that's a little bit more about what that was, you know, meant to say. And then to your question about kind of like, you know, wealth generation and the role of these intermediaries. And yeah, there's, you know, there was a big, you know, big news story kind of like a year or two ago about like a large, you know, pretty prominent individual who gave a ton of money towards climate and environment, and you know, and some EJ groups had some concerns about where it was going. So I think that you know, this is kind of beyond environmental justice too, but as there's increased you know, just wealth generation and you know, and also just as like the next generation of philanthropists are kind of coming into their own too. You know, I could foresee and have certainly heard from you know, from others to that end, the intermediaries playing a particularly important role. And the thing that, one thing that I'll just kind of, I think is important to keep in mind is that like, especially now as I step into like the Chicago Frontlines Funding Initiative role, you know, is that, it's important to understand how, for the intermediaries to understand kind of how they are, and, you know, and for partners and everyone involved to understand kind of, you know, ways that they are supporting folks and, you know, ways that they're just the power structure of how this is all set up, right, could potentially, you know, gatekeep as well. And so that's why I know a lot of, you know, I know a lot of these funds and intermediaries are, also, you know, definitely advocate for kind of direct connections between donors and, you know, and grantees and grantee partners to that end too.
What are some of the emerging issues that you're seeing from frontline communities? That's number one. And then number two, if I'm a donor right now and I have some funding that I want to deploy, and I'm just looking for some direction on where to go to or how I can really go about expanding my reach, what would be some suggestions you would offer up?
Yeah, it's a good question, or good set of questions. So, you know, I actually should also state, like, I'm not necessarily the expert to speak to directly what frontline communities are experiencing, so can only kind of lift up what I'm hearing. But to that end, you know, it depends kind of, right? There's, you have folks dealing with in, you know, California, you know, certainly wildfires have been an issue. They impact certain populations. Just heat, heat exposure, right, is a big deal for farm worker communities and things like that. In the Midwest, you have, you know, water is kind of, unlike in the West where water, there's not enough water, you know, in the Midwest, there's often too much water and you have, you know, things happening like increased flooding events, like what happened has happened in Detroit, you know, a lot in the past year, or, you know, say kind of the Flint water crisis, also something similar in Chicago with, you know, with lead service lines and kind of a need to replace those, to even just, you know, I mean, like, you know, hurricane impacts in the East Coast, kind of, you know, what's going on with the energy grid out there as well too. You know, that's maybe just a flavor, but to get to your question around, you know, if you were a donor, what would you do? I'd say like two things, right? So one is this piece around getting educated around environmental justice and doing so in a way that is learning really from, I'd actually, if folks are new to environmental justice, I'd consider expanding your horizon beyond like, beyond what you might learn from, maybe from folks you might turn to who you know, kind of in the environmental space, to really looking at like community-based organizations, frontline organizations. There's lots of great networks out there like Climate Justice Alliance, you know, folks who, all these national networks that sit on the Fund to Build Grasses Power, I'll say, as well as others too. And then secondly, you know, like we talked about, right? Power and philanthropy is a big deal. So it's not so much just like, you know, how am I getting funding to environmental justice organizations? It's also like, what is that? How is that funding allocated and what does it look like? So I really do think this piece around re-examining kind of your grant making practices and understanding how that could be, you know, making it more accessible to or creating a burden for these organizations to, you know, to receive funding from you is another critical piece to explore. And that's sort of a maybe a 2.5, you know, part to that is kind of understanding, like going through your own diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, journey to see kind of what may or may not be preventing, you know, you as a donor from like doing things like reducing, you know, reporting requirements or making applications, you know, much more simpler, even just doing away with applications altogether.
You're in Chicago. Steve, you can share with us now that you've lived there for some time and you've seen some initiatives followed through, if you could sort of elevate one of the initiatives that perhaps a frontline organization may be working on.
Yeah, certainly. So, like I mentioned, CFFI, Chicago Frontlines Funding Initiative, you know, supports five organizations, all of which are doing amazing work. One of them, you know, Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, they've been kind of a key leader in the city and, you know, doing environmental justice work here. I think I would just kind of, you know, certainly lift up the role that they've played in the city in terms of they were one of the leaders and kind of a big, you know, reason why there were the last two coal-fired power plants in the city of Chicago, you know, actually got shut down. And they also, you know, more recently, in 2020, you know, they were the reason why, or they're part of the reason, you know, why there was a big call to the city to investigate, you know, why actually a botched explosion that had happened from when they demolished one of those, you know, power plants, spread a whole bunch of dust all over the, you know, community in the Little Village neighborhood in Chicago. So I think they've been, you know, a key presence in the city. There, you know, like I said, there are lots of other organizations doing great work as well. And then maybe just one other thing that I'll speak to is, you know, so I mentioned the Clean Energy Jobs Act, CEJA in Illinois that recently just got passed. And now is, you know, it's great that it got passed and now it's into this implementation phase. And that's kind of a critical period especially for a lot of environmental justice bills, given that that's where we see kind of, you know, how this will play out. What I'm really excited by is the fact that, you know, through efforts like CFFI, we're able to see frontline organization, you know, leaders being able to participate in kind of this rulemaking, you know, in the sausage making of sorts to hopefully be able to get their voice in early and get these perspectives in early to ensure that, you know, what comes out of this will really be able to direct resources to these communities and do so in a way that's equitable, you know, and just to that end.
Thank you, man. It just speaks to the importance of the work that these organizations are sort of spearheading in each one of our communities, the importance of providing resourcing to them and also engaging them in decision-making and in sort of the best solutions to address the challenges that they're facing in their own communities. Just want to thank you so much for being part of this conversation today and look forward to reconnecting soon again.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, Alex. Always great to chat it up. You know, super appreciative to you all for the work you continue to do and the Fund Bill Grassley's Power, you know, with the Windward Fund. So thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.